I think you did better this week. Thank you for reading. Thank you for reading that. All right, we left off last week talking a little bit about corporate unity. And I appreciate the fresh perspective that was brought. I thought corporate unity, as I read through the text, was a good thing. You've got whenever Judah goes before the Lord and they say, where shall we go? Who shall go up to battle? And he says, Judah shall go up to battle. And so Judah says, hey, he goes to Simeon and says, hey, you want to go with me to battle? Simeon agrees and said, we'll go together. So I saw in verse 3, Judah and Simeon working together to capture the land and drive out the Canaanites as God commanded. And if you jump down in the text to verse 22, you see Ephraim and Manasseh, they're referred to as the tribes of Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh kind of worked together. I saw corporate unity within the Israelites as they drove the Canaanites out of the land as a good thing. Anyone else want to take another perspective at that? I think that there's something to be said about it. I guess the reason I thought it was good, Tommy, you want to say something real quick?
Well, something popped in my head that if you want to apply it to our everyday life, we're supposed to help each other. If somebody's struggling with in their lives, they should be able to come to another brother in Christ and ask for help, and that brother should be ready.
Okay. And Bill, would you mind reading for us from Ephesians chapter 3? I'm going to give him an easy New Testament passage. He's going to turn over and read Ephesians 3, 17 through 19 in just a moment. But let me speak real quickly about this. God said you to go up, and so there is something to be said, I believe, about doing the things that God says God's way. You've got a lot of churches and a lot of people claiming to be Christians and a lot of people trying to serve God that they don't necessarily follow the manner and the order in which God tells Christians to do certain things. Oftentimes when we look at worship or various doctrinal issues, they want to stray outside what God has said. And the point could be made that Judah did that. When Judah was told to go up, he goes to Simeon and says, hey, come with me. So there's something to consider about that, about doing things the way God said. I look and I see how both of the attacks were successful, though. And that's why I drew the application that working together in this instance was receiving God's blessing because both were successful. There doesn't appear to be anything negative said about Judah and Simeon going together. We'll look at maybe why that union made a little bit of sense here in just a moment. Bill, would you read Ephesians 3, 17 through 19, please? Think about the church today. How do we experience the fullness of the love of God? Is it individually? That's one of the things that I don't understand about people that say, well, I'm going to worship God in my own personal way, or I've got my own personal relationship with God. You talk about the depth of comprehending the depth and the width and the breadth of the love of Jesus Christ, together with all the saints, is the language that Paul uses. We're so much stronger together than we are apart. And that's kind of the point that I walked away with from Judges chapter 1 in this union amongst brethren between Judah and Simeon. When we join together, and as Tommy just pointed out a moment ago, whenever we work together, the strong with the weak, then we're able to accomplish what perhaps neither would be able to do individually. And that's the whole point of the church. That's why we have one another, is to lean upon one another's strengths in time of weakness. And so when we work together, you see God's blessings upon His own people as well. And that's kind of what I walked away with from Judges chapter 1, where you've got the corporate unity between the tribes as they seek to drive out the Canaanites. But think a little bit about Judah and Simeon's alliance. Why might Judah have gone to Simeon instead of one of the other tribes? It makes sense when you consider perhaps geographically the division of the 12 tribes. Back with chapter 2's questions on the left on that table, there's a map that shows a breakdown of the land of Canaan and where the 12 tribes were given their various inheritance. For one, you've got Judah and Simeon. You'll both remember they trace their lineage both back to Leah. So they're blood brothers in the sense of half brothers when you've got the sons of Rachel. So they're blood brothers. They're both of the daughter of the sons of Leah. And geographically, I think, is really the reason why you've got this. Whenever Josh was doling out the land of Canaan to the various tribes, if you see there, and the mic may be in the way, near the bottom, you've got the tribe of Judah that received the largest portion right there. And kind of just smack dab right in the middle of Judah's inheritance is the tribe of Simeon. So geographically, when you kind of look at how the land is divided, it seems to me that was probably why that Judah went to Simeon and said, hey, you want to go with me to conquer the land? Because they were going to be working amongst the same territory to begin with. And so when you see kind of where Simeon's placement is at, it makes sense for them to say, hey, you want to come help me? And then we'll in turn help you whenever we drive the Canaanites from your land. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe there isn't. Point is, they worked together to drive out the Canaanites. And you read... Okay, so yeah, if you're gonna attack Simeon, you're gonna have to attack Judah first, aren't you? Because they're protected by the land of Judah, so you're not really gonna get to Simeon's territory without Judah. So you would think that these two would, from the military perspective, militarily and strategically, they'd want to work together. They'd want their tribes to be close for multiple reasons, defensive being among part of the reason. And we read a little bit about this guy named Adonai Bezek. I don't know how you pronounce his name, but that's how I'm going to pronounce his name. When we read through most of our translations, mine's giving that name to him as a proper name. Has anyone here ever heard of the term Adonai before? It's a Hebrew term that's used a few times throughout the Old Testament. Usually it's translated as Lord or Master. And so just a little side note here, this Adonai Bezek guy that ruled in the land of Bezek, chances are it's referring to him as not as a proper noun, but it's simply saying that he is the Lord of Bezek. He's the Lord of this territory that the people from Judah and that the men from Simeon were going to drive out. Did anything strike you odd about their treatment of this king, the way they dealt with him? What did they do with him? Cut off his thumbs and his toes. What purpose might that have served? Okay, he can't go back to war. So they're handicapping him militarily, essentially, right? That'd be somewhat humiliating. I don't imagine there's just a whole lot of work that a guy without any big toes or thumbs would be able to do. So they're handicapping this guy. And what had he done? What had Adonai Bezek been? He says, I've done this as well, right? So he had said, 70 kings have begged for scraps under my table whose big thumbs and toes I've cut off. So... I found that kind of interesting. Not only was it humiliating, not only did it put an end to his military career, but what we're going to see in the next couple of chapters especially is we're going to see the Israelites, this process of Canaanization taking place, if you will. That is, they're going to embrace and they're going to practice the things that they're seeing in Canaan. And I think it really starts perhaps right here. Well, we may say this guy's just getting what he deserves because he did it to others. Well, that was a very Canaanite practice. They didn't go to the Lord and say, what should we do with this guy? Rather, they said, oh, he's got all these kings that he's cut their thumbs and big toes off. We're going to do the same thing to him. And so you're going to see the Israelites in a very rapid succession throughout the next couple of chapters begin this process of Canaanization, that is, implementing the practices and the deeds of the Canaanites. And I think you really see it starting right here in their treatment of this man. I think that's a step in the wrong direction. Comments or questions on those first seven verses? All right, let's move on, looking at verses 8 through 15. Buster, would you mind reading that for us, please?
Now the children of Judah had fought against Jerusalem, had taken it, smitten it with the edge of the sword, and set the city on fire. And afterward the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites that dwelt in the mountain, and in the south, and in the valley. Judah went against the Canaanites that dwelt in Hebron, and the name of Hebron before was Jathrabah, and they slew Shishan, Talmai, and from this he went against the inhabitants of Bar. The name of Bar before was Karajasper. And Caleb said, he that smiteth Karajasper and taketh it, to him I will give Ashah, my daughter, to wife. Nathanael, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it and gave him Ashah, his daughter. 15.
Yes, sir.
And it came to pass when she came to him that she moved him to ask her father a field. And she lighted from off her ass, and Caleb said unto her, what wilt thou? And she said unto him, give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a south wind, give me also springs of water. Caleb gave her the upper springs and the nether springs.
Well, that was a mouthful. From now on,
thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not picking on you, I promise. Just wait till we get to some of these further verses. You're not going to be alone in it. If anybody would like to pass on the reading, I don't mind. I don't mind being laughed at. These are some tough names to pronounce. So if you don't want to be called on to read, just say pass if I call on you, and we'll move to somebody else. And I have no problem at all butchering it. Trust me, I've done that plenty of times with other names. I've read publicly, so I'll be happy to do the reading in those events where we've got the challenging names to pronounce. Okay, so we see here the sons of Judah, verse 9, went down, and just as we looked at our map earlier, the terminology used there, when you look at where Judah is geographically, they would have indeed gone down. They've gone down into the south, and you'll see sometimes that referred to as, I believe, the Negev. Once again, that's how I would choose to pronounce it. They go down there to receive their inheritance. Now, Caleb. Where did we read about Caleb in times past? Who was he?
12.
Okay, he was. Okay. Do you remember what tribe he represented? Okay, he represented Judah. So he's one of the ones that goes down as he prepares to receive the inheritance. And you'll remember, he was an old man at this point in time. Whenever Joshua sent the 12 spies into the land, he was the one that went to represent Judah. He'd have been perhaps a younger man then, but the negative report that they brought back, 40 years wandering in the desert. And so 40 years later, after that generation of complainers has essentially died off, only Joshua and Caleb are allowed to enter into the land of Canaan. And so we have Caleb at this point in time as he prepares to receive his inheritance. He's not a spring chicken anymore. He's an older guy. And so what he does is perhaps he wants to see some other young man from Judah step up into his place. And so he says, I'm going to offer my daughter as wife to the person who runs these people out, who runs these Canaanites out from part of my portion of my inheritance. So let's look at question 5 on our list and talk a little bit about that just to kind of get some opinion here. You look at this interaction and the way that Caleb dealt with his daughter, Aksa, however you say that. So you look at how he dealt with her. Let's just get some thoughts on that. Was his dealing with her offering up perhaps as some sort of prize? Was that kind? Was that unkind? What do you think about that? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think if you remove yourself from this 2016 perspective and you put yourself back there, kind of like I think Miss Johnny's trying to do, maybe it's a tad, kind of, sort of, romantic, if you look at it in that sense. I don't know. Ladies, you might disagree with you might disagree, you might disagree. Perspective is very important here. We consider these verses. But hey, I'm a dad of a daughter. I kind of like this here. You know, maybe when Annabelle gets older and suitors come along, I'm going to say, you go capture some land and then we'll talk. Show yourself worthy. I mean, husbands today, you go and you ask the father for their daughter's hand and you give them a little piece of metal to put around their finger. This guy went to war for this woman. Okay, Othniel goes to war for Aksa at Caleb's request. He proves himself. He conquers the land. He drives out these Canaanites. Arranged marriages were just kind of the thing of the day. You know, that's kind of just the way things were. And if you think about Caleb, he's actually, I believe, taking care of his daughter well. He's doing a couple of things. First and foremost, he's securing for her a powerful husband, a man that's obviously able to handle himself in battle, and he's going to be a man who demonstrates leadership qualities. He's going to be a good husband. He's going to provide and care for and protect her. And secondly, you see his interaction with her. He doesn't demean her. He doesn't mistreat her. After he gives her this portion of land, and you'll remember, we go back and we look at the map, this is what's called the Negev. It's very dry, very arid territory. And so he's given Othniel and Aksa a portion of the inheritance from Judah. But it's very dry. And so when she comes and says, hey, Dad, we're going to need some water, you know, for this very dry territory, she's obviously got enough sense to understand they're not going to fare very well as a new family if they don't have some sort of water supply for crops and for animals and things like that. So she comes, she asks for water supply. He says, hey, what do you want? She says, we're going to need water. So it says he gives her the upper and the lower springs. So I find Caleb's treatment of his daughter in that day and time far from unfair. Now it's quite different than what we're used to seeing But you do see this care and concern for his daughter. He gives her the springs. Any other thoughts on that? Anybody else want to share their opinion?
My first thought was that he gave her a desert.
He did give her some springs too, though.
He asked for it, he gave her the water.
Right. So you see he concedes to that. Dave? Mm-hmm.
You know that he wasn't weak. He was still as strong
give,
as he was.
Give me that mountain.
So it could have been that Othniel was a little intimidated by her father, but that was her father, so she wasn't intimidated at all.
Right.
It's just an interesting.
Well, it's maybe that son-in-law father-in-law relationship never has changed, huh? it was the same way back then as it is now. There's just something intimidating sometimes about that. Bill? Okay. I believe it is. I think it's talking about the tribes of Judah and Simeon.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, Judah and Simeon, they would have died back in the land of Egypt.
Yeah,
what verse?
Verse 3.
Okay, verse 3. Judah said to Simeon, well, I think it's talking about the tribes themselves. You go down to verse 8. We see that the sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it with the edge of the sword. In verse 9, afterward, the sons of Judah. Sometimes you'll find, especially this book and others historically, they'll use those terms of the tribes to talk about those of the lineage of Judah and those of the lineage of Simeon. So you're right, Judah and Simeon have been long gone. And so these are their lineage, their sons that are going to war to receive their inheritance. Tommy?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the sons of Judah that were to go to war along with the sons of Simeon. They go to war and they receive their inheritance. Okay, let's talk just a little bit about Caleb and Othniel. As I was studying this, I came across what to me was an interesting discovery. Caleb was perhaps one of the most faithful men of his generation. Obviously, when you look at how only he and Joshua were the two that were willing to bring back the positive report. And only he and Joshua, of the same generation of Moses and Aaron, and those great men there, were allowed to enter into the land of Canaan. We know he was one of the two spies that brought back the good report. We know he was representative of the tribe of Judah. We know Othniel, he drove out the Canaanites from the city. He was the one that raised his hand and said, "I'll go to war, I'll drive them out." And he married Caleb's daughter. They were both from the tribe of Judah. Othniel, as we're going to see a little later on in chapter 3, he's the first judge of the children of Israel. What seemed interesting to me, the detail that I came across, is that it appears to me that these are not native-born Israelites. Rather, it seems like they have been proselytized into the children of Israel. And if you think about the great deeds that they've done, well, you think surely they've got to be of the children of Israel. Surely they've got to be native-born people. But when you trace their genealogy back, and we'll do this with a couple of verses, Judges 1 and 13, where we talk about Othniel. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, possibly his nephew is the language that's more accurate there, captured the city, and he gave him his daughter, Aksa's wife. So Othniel, the son of Kenaz. Back in the book of Judges 1:13, we see that it was only Joshua and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua the son of Nun, for they have followed the Lord fully. They were the only two to enter into the land. So you've got Othniel the son of Kenaz, you've got Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. You trace that name and that lineage back, you find it last mentioned in Genesis 36 verses 11 and 12. We talk about the sons of Eliphaz were Timnah, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Okay, Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Ada. And so you find there, Kenaz comes from the lineage not of Abraham, specifically, that is, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Rather, you find him coming from the lineage of Esau. Once again, I find that interesting because so oftentimes in the Jews today, they want to point toward those who are of pure blood, those who can trace their lineage back to Abraham. But yet you've got these two great men, Othniel and Caleb, who did very prominent things and very great things for the tribe of Judah. It doesn't appear that either one of them were native-born from the lineage of Jacob, but rather they came from Esau. But that also shows you God's welcoming into His fold, welcoming into His nation, the blessings and the responsibilities that come along with that, of those perhaps that weren't necessarily Jews by nationality. I found that an interesting detail, because you go from time to time and you look at individuals like Ruth and Rahab, and now, as I see, Caleb and Othniel, men who weren't necessarily born Jews, but who were yet became Jews, accepted the teachings of God, were welcomed into God's fold and received the blessings and did great things for God. So I just, once again, kind of like Ruth and Rahab, I find them interesting characters. So maybe you already knew that and that point was lost on you, but I found that as kind of an interesting detail. Any more comments, questions, or thoughts on Judges 1, 8 through 15? All right, let's move on a little more with our text. Who's our lucky reader now? Johnny? You want to read verses 16 through 21 for us, please?
The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms to the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is the south of Ararat, and they went and lived with the people. And Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they struck the Canaanites living in Zephath, and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. How far did you say? 21?
Yes. All right, so this is a question I've kind of been anxious to ask, and here's some of the response. We find here that some of the children of Israel were unable to drive out from the land some of the Canaanites. And so, question 6, what prevented the Israelites from conquering some of the Canaanite cities? Do you believe it was due to the Canaanites' resolve or to Israel's lack of faith? What do you think allowed the Canaanites to stay hunkered down in these cities?
Faith, definitely.
Okay, the lack of faith on behalf of the Israelites?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was fear, lack of faith. You know, back in Joshua, at least 23rd chapter, Joshua told them that, talked about what they had done as far as driving people out. He said, one man would drive off 1,000. And, so I think we know what God told them to do and that He would be with them. They didn't do it.
Okay.
That lack of fear was something that they saw was in their DNA. All through history, every time they saw something that looked greater than them, they won't turn their back on.
Okay. Well, we'll get to chapter 2 and we'll find out the children of Israel were faithful during the days of Joshua and the generation following. But I believe that's what's being described here is the days following Joshua, where they didn't drive out the Canaanites as they were commanded. All right, I saw Tommy, Johnny. Tommy first, please.
Okay. I think it's a lack of faith, definitely, but also a lack of resolve, to finish the job.
Okay.
They got them down to where they would pay a tribute to it, and maybe greed fell into it, too. You've got these people that are paying tribute, whether it was money or whether it was animals, or food sources. It could be a little bit of greed in there. Well, we don't have to fight them. We've got them conquered, and they'll give us this stuff.
Okay, good point. Ms. Johnny? Okay.
They could have done it. They knew how to do that.
Okay.
But here they seem to have
Okay. So kind of what I'm gathering is seems to be a lack of faith on behalf of the Israelites, huh? Well, let's look at a couple of other passages. I do believe that to some degree that there was a lack of faith there, but I don't think that was solely the only thing at play. You think about God's great victories. Jericho. They shouldn't have been able to take Jericho. But you see God's grace in delivering Jericho to them. You think about what God did in Egypt. You think about what God did with the Amalekites, the giants that they were able to defeat in battle. And so it seems like to me, as everyone has said, that these Canaanites, even with their iron chariots, shouldn't have been able to stand against the Israelites when you think about all that's done. And so initially I want to attribute, it was the Israelites' lack of faith that really led to the Canaanites dwelling in the land rather than the Canaanites themselves and their resolve and determination to stay there. I've got Joshua 17, 16 through 18 down. I don't remember why, but let's go over there and figure that out. Joshua 17, 16 through 18. For some reason, I thought that was a good passage to consider previously. All right. Dave, would you mind reading that for us, please? Brother Barker?
Okay. But the children of Joseph said, the mountain country is not enough for us. And all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those who are of Beth Shean and its towns and those who are of the valley of Jezreel. And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a great
Yes, please.
But the mountain country shall be yours, although it is wooded. You shall cut it down, and to its furthest extent shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong.
Okay, and that's the passage Miss Johnny was talking about when she said that Joshua had previously told the Israelites, you're going to drive out the Canaanites, even though they've got the iron chariots. Exodus 23:29. Exodus 23:29. This is God speaking to the children of Israel. Now, he's speaking at a different time period. He's speaking through Moses. So, let's read this verse when you get over there. He says, and he's talking about the land of Canaan and that conquest. He says, I will not drive them out before you in a single year. And this is why. That the land may not become desolate, and that the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I probably should have stayed there and read verse 30 as well. I think that seemed like, I'll drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. So you kind of see there the flip side of the coin. God says, I'm not going to drive them out all at once. The land will become barren. All the animals, all the vegetation will die. And so it's going to be a gradual process. One last verse to consider back in Judges, chapter 2 and verse 23. And I'm just presenting kind of the other side of the equation. Like I say, I do believe there was a definite lack of faith. But it also seems like it was part of God's plan that the Canaanites not be entirely driven out all at once. All right, Judges chapter 2, look at verse 23. We see that the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly. He did not give them into the hand of Joshua. So we see that Israel, in a certain degree, they were going to be tested. And if you go back and look at verse 22, it tells why. So that they were going to be tested, whether they'll keep the way of the Lord and whether they're going to walk in the way of their fathers. So on one hand, you got God saying, you're going to be tested. They're not all going to be driven out at once. And on the other, you got Joshua who's saying, they've got iron chariots, but you're going to drive them out anyway. And so, was it the Canaanites' persistence? Or was it God's part of God's plan that they not be all driven out at once? Johnny?
Into the sinful, idolatrous ways. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons
God kept testing them, you know, they wouldn't remain faithful.
Okay. So I think there are elements of all of that there. I think that in a sense, God was testing the people. I mean, we're tested today. We live in a world where we find ourselves facing temptations on a daily basis. And you know, it'd be easy for us to perfectly follow God if God drove out all the temptations before us and we never had to deal with those and we never encountered hardships and we never encountered things that we desire that God said, you don't need to have a part in this. At the same time, you see that with His people. I'm not going to entirely drive them out. I'm going to allow them to test you. I'm going to find out if you're as faithful as your father's. Or if your faith is like your direct fathers who complained and didn't fully obey and were fearful. And I think you have, perhaps whenever this testing occurred, that's where the lack of faith came in. And because of the testing that God allowed, even though they could have driven them out, they didn't drive them out all the way because of their perhaps superior technology or the challenge that it would have been. And so I think you've got just a lack of faith. And part of God's plan, too, was so that the land just didn't fall to desolation, that it be a gradual process, and that they all not be driven out at once. So I think you've got multiple elements there. All of that said, at the beginning of the class, I said there may not always be a 100% right answer. I think when you look at all of it together, you understand why it was that the Canaanites remained in the land. That could have been part of the temptation, right? John?
I think it's another factor here why God also did not want to leave to take the land all at once. These people didn't know anything. They had been wandering all this time in the wilderness, those that were there and had grown up there. Those that had any knowledge at all had all died. And they came into the land of Canaan. They didn't know how to take care of the land. They had something to learn. They had to figure out how to take care of what was there. And I think that played
a part. So the fact that they need to learn kind of the agricultural things and how to manage land, they just didn't die off. Of course, I think God would have blessed them one way or the other, but that's a good point to consider. Good point to consider. Any other thoughts or comments on the verses we've looked at this morning? We'll pick up next week in verse 22, and we'll finish out chapter 1 next week, I'm sure. We may be able to delve into chapter 2 a little bit. So I thank everyone for their participation and their attention this morning in our class.